Good afternoon. My name is Phyllis, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Center for American Progress on Medicaid. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Lotus, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining the Center for American Progress call on Medicaid and the middle class. On today's call, Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute and Scott Lilly of the Center for American Progress will discuss the impact of cuts to Medicaid on seniors, the disabled, and pregnant women. Mr. Ornstein is a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call and is an election analyst for CBS News. He serves as co-director of the AEI Brookings Election Reform Project and participates in AEI's Election Watch series. Scott Lilly, a senior fellow at American Progress, released a new paper, The Ryan Medicaid Plan, A Threat to Middle Class Security, that examines the impact of potential Medicaid cuts. Mr. Lilly writes and researches in a wide range of areas, including governance, federal budgeting, national security, and the economy. He joined the center in March of 2004 after 31 years of service with the United States Congress. As a reminder, today's call will be recorded. Scott?
Thank you, and I want to thank Norm for agreeing to join us and talk about Medicaid. It's a issue that I've spent a good deal of time in the last several months looking at, and that's because I think it is poorly understood. And I also think that we are in a situation where millions of people who have benefits from Medicaid are being threatened with the loss of those benefits without really knowing that they're on the table. And with the Congress, the executive branch doing little formal vetting of the proposals that might be adopted to change Medicaid. If you go to the House website, you'll find several versions of a little booklet called How a Bill Becomes a Law, including a cartoon version for elementary and elementary school students. All of those versions emphasize the rigorous scrutiny and transparency required to adopt any legislation. A bill has to be referred, after it's introduced, referred to committees. It has to have hearings. It has to have comments from outside experts. Testimony can be submitted before it is even brought to the full committee for vote. It then goes to the House where it's debated and subject to amendments, and then the same process is repeated in the other body. But we are in a situation where virtually none of those safeguards to the public's ability to know and defend itself has been used, and the prospect that in a matter of days we could have sweeping changes in Medicaid presented to the Congress for an up or down vote as part of a package that would depend on whether we defaulted on our debt. So we are looking at what are the possible implications of major changes in Medicaid, and in particular the ones that have been put on the table now that we have more detail about, the Ryan proposal. When you look at Medicaid, I think you get a mosaic of a very complicated program that has many aspects to it, but it is a very different mosaic than what many politicians or the public suppose it to be. Among the people that are affected, and in particular the places that Medicaid money goes, we find a great many instances where ordinary middle-class people who face a health catastrophe are at least prevented from financial ruin, or their families are prevented from financial ruin as a result of Medicaid. I think if that safeguard is removed, that it will prove to be very unpopular. And I think that you could have a repeat of what happened in 1997 when a lot of poorly thought through changes in the Medicare program were adopted as part of an overall compromise and later removed from the package when people began to realize what was happening. The problem there is that you jeopardize a great many people, you create uncertainty, and in the end you end up with a proposal to reduce the deficit that doesn't do that. So I will I'll turn it over to Norm, and then I'll be happy to take questions. Thank you.
I'd make a few initial comments. This whole budget debate is enough to give anyone a severe case of heartburn now, because it's turned into something that's moved even beyond the realm of the absurd. This no longer has to do with reducing deficits or using the debt limit as a way of reducing deficits. It's all become a way to jawbone down spending, whatever the consequences, without a dime in tax increases. And it's just hard to get a handle on how crazy that dynamic is. But even before that, I was getting troubled by the fact that we were talking about cuts in the growth of spending without any real significant discussion of how we prioritize those cuts or what the consequences would be, and especially in the health realm. And what we would do that, in the name of expediency now, would involve perhaps a short-term benefit of reducing government spending, but with much, much larger costs. And that, unfortunately, has infected the whole debate, and I use the term loosely, about health, because that debate has largely ignored the fact that the biggest drivers of the health costs on the government side, especially, come from the so-called dual eligibles, the share of the population that's a relatively small share who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, but end up being a very, very substantial share of both Medicare and Medicaid. They tend to be, of course, very chronically ill and to have significant disabilities. Put that together with the costs of terrible diseases like diabetes and the end of life, and you deal with the single most dramatic components of health inflation. And all of the talk about how if we only move Medicare to a market system where people can use the market to reduce costs ignores the fact that people in these categories couldn't use the market if their lives depended on it, and their lives do depend on it. And that in the Medicaid system, especially, and as we look at the dual eligibles, where there's no coordination between these programs, Medicare and Medicaid were not designed to work in sync. The Medicaid system was not originally designed to be a program significantly of long-term care for the elderly or the way we deal with serious mental and physical disabilities. And the fact that so many Medicaid providers are so poorly paid, we get costs shuffled back and forth between the programs with no focus on either what's best for the patients or what ends up being significant cost savers, and it becomes a significant cost driver. And I've looked very hard to try and find some element of this in all of these intensive discussions over what we're going to do to get our fiscal house in order, and they're not there. And that means that if we do end up making these cuts, it will not only be very difficult for the people who are involved, many of whom, as Scott said, are not simply the poor, the working poor. There are people who were in our middle class, or many of whom have been driven towards poverty because of these costs. But perversely, it's going to end up costing more money or costing the society an opportunity for growth and not saving. And I'll stop with that.
Thank you. Let's open it up for questions. Reminder, if you have a question, plus press star 1. At this time, there are no questions, so we will conclude our call. As a reminder, this call was recorded. If you have any questions, please email me at llodes@americanprogress.org. Thank you so much.